From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Well, here's another one of those moments where Shakespeare indeed had the wisest words. To sleep, perchance to dream. Of course, Hamlet was worried that he would dream that he had died and thus would never find actual peace from his earthly troubles. But in truth, dreams themselves might be a fantastic way to work through those very troubles that rule our waking lives. New research claims that we're doing a lot of important work when we dream, important work for our physical and emotional health, and that we ought to pay more attention to what happens to our inner lives when we sleep. This hour on Point, why we dream. And you can join us. Do you keep a dream journal? What do you make of your dreams? Have you had a premonition from one of your dreams? And does your dream life influence your waking life at all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from New York is Alice Robb. She's a science journalist and author of Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. There's an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Alice, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Okay, so I wonder if you could actually talk to us a little, get us started by telling us the story of how you first got interested in studying more about the what we know about the science of dreams. What drew you into it?
I had always had a pretty vivid dream life, and I would wonder about my dreams in the morning. But my interest really deepened one summer in college. I was studying archaeology, and I went on an archaeological dig in a remote area in Peru, and I didn't have internet access. I read all the books that I had brought, and a friend of mine had this book that was a guide to lucid dreaming. And lucid dreaming, which I'd never heard of, is when you become aware while you're in a dream that you're in a dream, and you can sometimes exercise control over what happens in the dream. And I didn't have that much to do that summer, so I started doing all these exercises to try to induce lucid dreams. So one of them is you ask yourself throughout the day whether you're awake or asleep, and the idea is you then ask that question in a dream, answer that you're asleep, and have a lucid dream. And I started having these lucid dreams and found them just very exhilarating and exciting. And from there, I really wanted to learn more about what's going on when we dream.
Well, what were some of those dreams like?
I remember very clearly the first lucid dream I ever had, where I was just, it was really simple. I was just floating in a pool. But I was so aware of how the water felt and just how extraordinary it was that I was in my bed and also swimming in a pool.
So I want to get to the, you've written an entire book about this and about the science and what we know about dreams now today. And we'll explore that. But let me just get right to a doubter's question. How do you know you were really lucid dreaming and you weren't just dreaming that you were awake while you were dreaming? Do you know what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit hard to describe if you've never experienced it. But it's sort of a unique state of consciousness where you have this awareness of your body and just you're saying to yourself, I'm in a dream.
And then you're telling yourself consciously that you're in a dream, even though you're asleep.
Yes, it's like you've woken up within the dream.
Maybe I'm struggling with this a little bit because I've never done it before myself. It counteracts the common understanding of what a sleep state is, right? Or what the dream state is when we're in the REM sleep state, right? Because I always just presumed that it was your unconscious mind kind of unfolding and doing some work. And it doesn't make sense to me about how consciousness can rule over the unconscious mind when we sleep.
Well, there's actually a suggestion that lucid dreaming is more like a hybrid state of consciousness between being awake and being asleep, and that some parts of your brain that are typically not activated in REM sleep are active while you're in a lucid dream.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So you had these lucid dreams, and then you also said you write in the book how you began writing what you remembered when you woke up. You began writing down your dreams, and that sometimes it went mm-hmm. from being little fragments of things to then over time more detailed recollections of what you had dreamt. And what impact did that have on you?
Well, I found it really amazing how quickly my dream recall improved. As soon as I started paying attention, just making an effort to, before I got into bed, say, you know, I want to remember my dreams tonight. And then first thing in the morning, reaching for my dream journal and writing down whatever I could remember, or if I couldn't remember anything, just writing that down. And because the thing that I think people don't realize is that you're dreaming every night, every time you have a REM cycle. So that's every 90 minutes, four or five times a night, you're having some dream activity. So most people, even with high dream recall, only remember one or two a night. But if you wake up more in the night or, you know, make an effort, you can remember as many as four or five dreams a night. And so part of this was I just found it really interesting that I'd been having all these dreams and then forgetting them all my life. And it just felt like I was, you know, sort of expanding my consciousness by becoming more aware of them.
Okay, so maybe we should take a step back here and sort of do sleep sleep 101, because you mentioned the sleep cycles. I think it's important to just sort of lay that out. I can't remember how many sleep cycles there are, but it's only but REM sleep is the last of them before you cycle back to the beginning of your sleep cycles. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So you talk about 5 stages of sleep, with REM being the last one. And you're going through that cycle that includes slow wave sleep, deep sleep, and then the final one is REM. And each REM cycle actually gets longer over the course of the night. So your first REM cycle might be just 10 minutes, and then your final REM cycle could be as long as an hour. So your dreams also tend to get progressively more vivid and more emotional over the course of the night. So you're having, towards the time that you're waking up, these are also the dreams you're most likely to remember, you're having the most story-like emotional dreams.
Oh, interesting. Okay, maybe I have so much sleep interruption at night that this might be one of the reasons why I don't remember anything every morning. But so what is it that the brain's actually doing in a dream state?
So it's... What's going on is the logic centers of your brain, like the frontal lobe, are less active, and the emotion centers of the brain, the amygdala, the limbic system, are more active. So that's part of why you're having these sort of very emotional and absurd stories.
And why is that important for our waking life?
So dreams have effects on our waking life in a few ways. One idea is that when we dream, we're rehearsing for events that we're stressed about. So that would explain why most dreams are much more negative than positive. When scientists started looking at dreams systematically, they found that some of the most common emotions in dreams were fear and anxiety, helplessness. And they wondered, you know, why would we be having such unpleasant experiences every night? And then one answer is that we're using them to prepare. It's like a dress rehearsal for things that are threatening or dangerous in the daytime.
Oh, okay. Hey, Alice, hang on for just a second, because on what you just said, I want to go to a caller here. Kristen is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to tell you that I tend to have sometimes very vivid dreams that, you know, it's all about the feeling that you have. And sometimes a dream will stay with you the next day and you're wondering what it means. So just, it won't be brief, but I had a dream recently that I was leaving a place, looking around, had taken a last look, and I put a bag on each shoulder. So very vivid. I felt the weight of a bag going on each shoulder. And the dream just stayed with me so much the next day that I thought about it a lot. And, you know, I went about my business, and I was at a CVS. And after I made my purchase, I stood and just took an extra minute and read an article in a magazine, you know, after I'd paid. And then I walked back to my car where it had been parked in Arlington. And there was a police car, a couple police cars. It was an ambulance. I started walking towards my car, and I was kind of in disbelief because my car had been crushed to half the width. And there were a couple of teenage boys that said, dude, that's your car. Oh, my God. It was the first one hit. So essentially what happened is a drunk driver had come, hit my car, ricocheted off a bunch of other cars, and then was being ferried away in the ambulance as I arrived.
Yeah.
And I was kind of in a daze. I wasn't upset. And the tow truck driver, you know, said, just take what you need because we're going to impound your car. And I went to the trunk and I took out my gym bag and I put it on my left shoulder and I took out my briefcase and put it on my right shoulder. And that's when it hit me that that's what the dream had prepared me for, was to take what I need, not come back. And I think it just helped in my reaction that I sort of had that same feeling of a very matter of fact, not upset. But I feel like, in a way, it kind of prepared me.
Wow. Okay. Kristen, thank you so much for your call. So, Alice Robb, one example there of, at least anecdotally, about how you were talking about dreams sort of help us process or deal with threats in reality. That would, Kristen's dream sounded more like a premonition, perhaps, than anything, or at least she was calling it preparation. What do you think?
Yeah, I think dreams can absolutely, they give us this opportunity to prepare for things in an environment that has no stakes. I've certainly had the experience of, you know, you have a dream about the worst case scenario. You turn up for the interview and you're an hour late or you forgot to wear clothes. And then you wake up and you think, okay, like, that's not going to happen. And you feel sort of more comforted.
Wow. Well, Alice Robb joins us this hour. She's the author of the new book, Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. And you can join us. What do you think the importance of dreams are? What kind of work are we doing for our minds, our bodies, our spirits when we dream at night? We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Alice Robb. She's author of the new book, Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. And there's an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Alice, so, you know, I just have to ask you here. You write in the book about how we are in this sort of amazing time when it comes to sleep research and understanding the science of sleep. But perhaps the studying dreams and how they're generated and what they're doing for us is that's an area of science or exploration that's been impeded somewhat over time, even though over the history of humanity, I guess, dreams have really played a central role in how we understand the world. So who do we look to, or where do we look to understand why we've been neglecting understanding our dreams better in modern life?
So as you said, there's been, dating back to Aristotle, people have written about dreams and talked about dreams. And throughout really the 19th century, you see even in the U.S., like newspapers printing readers' dreams and really taking them seriously as a part of life on a continuum with waking experience. And then when Freud comes along with the interpretation of dreams in 1900, he, on the one hand, he put dreams at the center of psychoanalysis and gave them this academic legitimacy, but he also popularized the idea that dreams are all about sex and neurosis and, you know, that dreams are wish fulfillment and often erotic wish fulfillment. And the idea that, you know, climbing up a ladder in dreams is really a symbol for sex and, you know, hammers and neckties are phallic symbols.
Yeah.
That idea kind of took root and it made people embarrassed to talk about dreams. They became like innuendos.
Well, but before that, before Freud, and we'll talk about Freud and his impact a little bit more in a second here, but you're right, how before that, recollecting dreams was, you know, even a central part in how, you know, people in law enforcement would ask folks about that, or doctors, I can't quite remember, but that they weren't dismissed out of hand.
Yeah, there are stories of people, you know, going to the police and saying, I had a dream that, you know, this person committed the murder. Or there are Victorian tabloids where they would like illustrate the dreams of criminals. They were just seen as a real part of experience and source of information.
Okay, so then Freud's popularity and his theories then sort of relegated dreams to meaning virtually only one set of things. And is that what really put the brakes on further investigation and research into why we dream, what we dream about, and their implications?
I think that's a big part of the story. There was also, amid the backlash to Freud in the 1970s, 1980s, an idea became popular that dreams are just the product of biology and they're just essentially the brain getting confused and making up some nonsense because of sort of getting its wires crossed.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This has really inspired quite a number of people to call us. So let me just get some more callers in here. We're talking about dreams and why we dream. And Alice Robb joins us. She's the author of a new book titled Just That, Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. I want to know what you dream about, why you dream about it, and why you think that maybe understanding our dreams and both the biological and mental processes behind that are important for our waking life. Let's go to Ryan, who's calling from Riverview, Florida. Ryan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Nice to speak with the both of you. So my question actually centers around those people who don't dream. I'm in my 30s, and the last time I remember dreaming was when I was in elementary school.
Elementary school. Okay, so you said the last time you remember dreaming, but Alice was telling us a little earlier that you dream in every REM sleep cycle, so you should be dreaming every 90 minutes while you're asleep. Maybe you're just not remembering them.
Is that a biological thing, or is there something I can do to help that?
Okay, Ryan, hang on here. Don't hang up. Let me turn back to Alice. Can Ryan change this?
I would say that you probably can. Often people who don't remember their dreams are sound sleepers who sleep all the way through the night, so that might be a good thing. But most of us really are dreaming every night. And if you just make thinking about dreams a part of your day, especially before bed, think about how you want to dream. Even just having this conversation or listening to this interview could make you more likely to remember your dreams. But in the sleep lab, when people are woken up right as they're coming out of a REM period, they can recall a dream 80 to 90% of the time.
Huh. Well, Ryan, so maybe there is hope for you remembering those dreams. I hope so. What do you think?
Yes, I sure hope so. I'm definitely a sound sleeper, so it definitely fits.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for calling, Ryan. Let's go to Jackie, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I'm going to be buying this book. You need to invest. I am a very heavy dreamer since the time I was a very, very young child. And there's times where I have dreamt things and been like, it's so vivid, so real that I'm not quite sure if I'm recalling a memory. Am I, you know what I'm saying? But my biggest issue is that I have nightmares every single night. And it does not matter if I've had a good day, a bad day, whatever. I found out I was a narcoleptic person, which is a kind of a silent epidemic going on, and people have it and don't realize it. But I don't know what to do about. I've written down dream journals and nightmare stuff, and I don't know how to deal with these dreams that are so they get so overwhelming, and it makes me not want to sleep, which just exacerbates.
Wow, Jackie. Wow. Okay, so don't put the phone down here, Alice. I mean, it sounds like this is where one example in which someone's sleeping life is almost interfering with her waking life.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that people with narcolepsy sometimes have these very thin boundaries between their dreaming and their waking lives. There are there isn't a simple solution that I know of to nightmares. There's a treatment being developed that uses virtual reality to try to treat nightmares. The idea is you go into this virtual reality and you're shown images that that evoke the emotions that you experience in nightmares. So fear or anxiety, and you practice manipulating the images. And that's supposed to help you, like, practice mastering nightmares. But it's still in, I think, relatively early stages. In the meantime, I'm not sure, maybe... treating the narcolepsy.
Right. Well, Jackie, first of all, thank you so much for your call. And tell me a little bit more. You said you were concerned. Sometimes it makes you worried about going to sleep because your nightmares are so real. Jackie, you still there? Oh, looks like we lost her. But thank you so much for your call, though, Jackie. Let's go to one more. David is calling from Buffalo, New York. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Allison, Magna. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem. What would you like to share?
So this is kind of a funny NPR-related dream story. In college, I had terrible insomnia just from the stress of having a lot of homework and studying. And so my doctor told me to start taking melatonin so that I could just get to bed at a reasonable hour. And one of the side effects of the melatonin was that I would have waking dreams of whatever I was hearing towards the end of my sleep. And so my alarm on my clock radio was NPR. And so right before I'd wake up, I would actually have these dreams that I was in the NPR studio in, like, morning edition. I forget what it was. So it was, and then I stopped taking the melatonin because it was fun, but it was starting to freak me out a little bit. But I'd start figuring out I was asleep, and I'd sort of slap myself in my dream to try and wake myself up. And then it was, I don't know when it started, but I started becoming conscious of the fact that I was dreaming and trying to get myself out of it.
Well, first of all, David, I am so glad that you were saying that NPR was on your alarm to help wake you up, because I was fully anticipating you saying that NPR was on at night to help you fall asleep. I have done that before. Full disclosure, I've used the radio to help me fall asleep. But David, now you're not in the studio, but at least you're on an NPR show in reality. So maybe we're making your dreams come true here. But tell me a little bit more about how realistic or potent those dreams were right before you woke up. Did you say that they were making you a little nervous?
It was more just like. I wasn't necessarily nervous, but there was something about it happening every day that I was like, I don't know, I wasn't wild about having the same waking dream every day. It was like sort of blurring reality and sleep in a weird way, but I would have, I didn't know what anyone I listened to looked like, so my mind would invent a face for someone, but I would actually dream that I was sitting next to these people in a studio. And one time they were doing an obituary for someone who had headlined at Woodstock, and I dreamed I was at Woodstock when they started playing audio of this guy playing the guitar. It was like really kind of amazing.
Wow. Well, David, thank you so much for your call. Alice, what do you hear in David's story there?
I think if he is enjoying his dream. I mean, sounds good.
Sounds good. Okay. Well, we've got some comments coming here on our website. Marcus Six says, from the research I've seen, there really is nothing to our dreams. There's a lot going on in our heads when we're dreaming, but the dreams themselves mean nothing. So he says, Marcus, or he or she says, if it's about premonitions or anything spiritual, it's like horoscopes, a bit of fluffy fun. But if it's about memory consolidation and some real science, I'm in. Well, on that note, let me turn now to Deirdre Barrett. She joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's an assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And she's the past president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. And she is the editor-in-chief of the association's journal called Dreaming. Deirdre Barrett, welcome to you.
Hi.
So help us understand here from a biological or scientific perspective. I asked Alice this question earlier, but maybe we can get your expertise here. What exactly is happening in the brain when we're dreaming?
Well, we're thinking in a very different biochemical state, as Alice mentioned. Our prefrontal area that has to do with logic is turned way down, not off, but way down. Emotional areas are more active. And I think the one thing I didn't hear her say is our secondary visual cortex is much, much more active, which is what generates the hallucinatory visual content during dreaming. But I believe we're still concerned with all the same problems, issues. I mean, we dream a lot about our personal emotional life, but we also dream about our work and practical problems and politics and things in the news. And while we're not thinking as logically about it, there's certain kinds of problems and issues that the vivid visualization or even the lack of the prefrontal area helps us to kind of think outside the box. So some problem solving happens in dreams sometimes. It's just, it's a very different state.
Well, as Marcus Six was asking, if it's about memory consolidation or real science, they're curious. I mean, are there things that we're achieving in our dreams? You mentioned problem solving, but are there other things that we're achieving in our dreams or doing for ourselves that for some reason we're not capable or less capable of doing in our waking lives?
Well, definitely some memory consolidation is happening, especially emotional, social kinds of memories and very creative things seem to get consolidated more during rapid eye movement sleep, which is when most dreams occur. If you deprive people of that, you don't get as much of the social learning, creativity. Some other stages of sleep are perhaps more important for other memories, but that seems to be a biochemical thing about REM sleep. But just because we know one function doesn't mean there are not lots of others layered on top of it. And the actual dream content seems to be solving problems, thinking about other ways of doing things. Sometimes, I think just like with our waking thought, lots of it is trivial. Lots of it is stuff we already know. Lots of it is going in circles. But definitely in research on problem-solving dreams, people do have them sometimes, and especially ones that are very visual in their nature, or especially ones where we're stuck because the conventional wisdom is wrong.
I see.
Are ones where dreams helpful.
Interesting. So the sleep state and the inhibition of certain parts of our conscious brain then is what allows us to more effectively engage with the problems that are plaguing us?
Yeah, having your logic turned down is if you know how to solve a problem accurately, is not going to be helpful. But in situations where you think you know how to solve it and the way you're approaching it is wrong, I mean, in science, the classic example is Kekulé. When he was trying to figure out the structure of benzene, he knew the atoms, but we didn't have an electron microscope back then that could just look in and see how they were arranged. So all known molecules were some kind of straight line with a side chains coming off them, and he was trying to arrange the atoms that way and couldn't find an arrangement that made sense. And he fell asleep, and he saw atoms in front of him, and they began to form into snakes. He called them straight lines. And then one of them reached around, grabbed its tail in its mouth in a circle, and he woke up realizing that benzene was a circular structure, which was the first molecule known to be that way. And it was the fact that his dreaming brain let go of the idea all molecules have to be a straight line with a right angle side chain coming off it, that let him solve it.
Right.
Sometimes our conventional wisdom is holding us back.
Well, Deirdre, we just have about 30 seconds to go here before the break, but now suddenly there's a big question that pops into mind. Is there documented evidence of a relationship then between dreams and creativity or greater creativity?
Yes. I mean, first of all, there are just studies asking creative people, artists and novelists, et cetera, how often they use their dreams in their work. And it's much higher than for some fields that we would not think of as creative. And I've also done research asking people to think about a problem that they are trying to solve but haven't yet at bedtime. And we find that intentionally trying to increases the rate of problem solving or creativity sparking dreams.
Well, Deirdre Barrett, stand by here for just a second. And Alice Robb, hang in here as well. We are talking about why we dream. That's the title of Alice Robb's new book, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about why we dream this hour. That's the title of Alice Robb's new book. It's called Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. And she joins us. And Deirdre Barrett is also with us. She's assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and editor-in-chief of the journal Dreaming, the journal of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Now, we couldn't help it. We just have to play one clip from the dreamiest, I mean, I'm putting that in quotes, dreamiest movie that we could think of, and that's Inception, Christopher Nolan's movie. He was writer and director of that film. He said he was inspired to make Inception by his desire to show what it felt like to be in a lucid dream. So here's a scene where Cobb, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, talks to his new coworker, Ariadne, played by Ellen Page, about some of the properties lucid dreamers will recognize.
They say we only use a fraction of our brain's true potential. Now, that's when we're awake. When we're asleep, our mind can do almost anything.
Such as?
Well, imagine you're designing a building, right? You consciously create each aspect. But sometimes it feels like it's almost creating itself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, like I'm discovering it.
Genuine inspiration, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in a dream, our mind continuously does this. We create and perceive our world simultaneously, and our mind does this so well that we don't even know what's happening.
A scene there from Inception. Deirdre Barrett, what do you think of the description that Leonardo DiCaprio gives there in that scene?
I think it's pretty accurate. I thought the film Inception, in the first half of it, it had a lot of things that were very, very true to dreams. There's another little bit where he's testing the architect on whether she can remember how she got to this cafe, which is a common way for people to become lucid when they realize they're not in touch with their usual memories. The film kind of turned into a just chase scenes thing toward the end. But I thought it had a lot of very true-to-dream stuff in the first half.
Okay, well, we've got some callers here, so let's go to them. Prunella is calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been having lucid dreams since I was a very young child. And for 7 years, I had the same dream on the same day, and it was a nightmare. I was told in that seventh year of having it seven times by someone who's come to visit me many times in my dreams that I didn't have to go to that place. And they taught me how to get out of my dreams when I was six. So I remember my dreams from when I was a very small child. Mm-hmm. I visit my parents in my dreams. Dreams are very important. I visit many people and get many teachings and many lessons when I'm sleeping. I was recently prescribed a drug as well for a problem that I was having, And when anyone ever gives me a prescription, which I don't take many prescription drugs, I ask them if it will affect my dreams. And this one would have, and I found another way to heal myself because I would never do anything that would stop my dreams.
Right.
I'm also an artist, a photographer. And one of the other things that I do, I'm a teaching artist, is one of my assignments is a dreamscape that people have to create, what they can pull out of their mind. Now, many people don't remember their dreams, but I have had students come to me and tell me after they've done this exercise that uh-huh. they've been able to occasionally, not every night, but occasionally recall what they've experienced in their dream.
Right. Well, Prunella, thank you so much for your call. Deirdre Barrett, let me turn back to you because I was interested in Prunella saying that she's, in her dream, she's engaging with, I guess, family members who have passed on there. Is that, what is that? Is that another form of emotional problem solving that we're doing in our sleep?
Certainly. I mean, the whole question of the concrete reality of that, even of the survival of death, I think is sort of outside the realm of dream psychologists. But yeah. I found in one study of dreams about the deceased that people were extremely comforted by seeing them again. They got great advice, such as they would have in waking life. And interestingly, at similar levels, whether they believed that they were actually talking to the spirits of the deceased and that this was completely real, or if they thought that this was metaphoric and, you know, and they were just remembering the person more vividly than they could awake and kind of modeling what they would do. It definitely leads a lot of people to a lot of comfort, but also a lot of concrete good advice.
Huh. Well, Alice Robb, let me turn back to you here, because in the book, you know, speaking of engaging or thinking about death, you write in the book about people who have very vivid dreams prior to their deaths. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. There was a study a few years ago of hospice patients in New York that found that the majority of them were having very vivid dreams, and they were often a source of great comfort to people as they were dying, and they would be, you know, they would be meeting with people who had already died, long-lost relatives, or a lot of people had these metaphors about going on a journey, meeting with angels and, you know, just saying goodbye.
Huh. Okay. And Deirdre Barrett, what do you think about that? What do we know about how what the brain's doing just prior to passing away?
I'm not sure how much it relates to the biological processes. It's just obviously psychologically,
right.
If you're dying, that is the most important thing on your mind, and we dream about any major issue that we're facing, but that would just be the extreme of that.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm familiar with that research.
Yeah.
And lots of people seem to have powerful death dreams that make the death process easier for them.
So can I want to just go to the opposite end of life here for a second and just share purely anecdotally, do dreams serve a particular function in developing children? And I ask because I noticed in my little brood that whenever they reached or were approaching kind of a developmental milestone, my kids would like practice a lot to the point of like physically practicing in their sleep. You know, my son would occasionally practice walking around in his sleep. My daughter frequently would use words that in her sleep that she hadn't used, at least insofar as I'd heard, while being awake. So was there some sort of practice or problem solving critical to childhood development going on in their brains?
I think children do use dreams for problem solving just like adults. And of course, a lot of their problem solving is about confronting new things and practicing. Although sleepwalking and sleep talking do not necessarily occur during dreaming sleep.
I see.
Sleepwalking is usually you're not dreaming. You're in a deeper stage of sleep. And sleep talking, about 20% of it is out of dreams, and the more elaborate utterances are usually out of dreams, but we talk a lot in non-dreaming sleep also.
Okay. Wow. I mean, the sleeping brain is such a remarkable thing. Let's go to Karen, who's calling from East Aurora, New York. Karen, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. It's a little bit of a long story, but I'll go as fast as I can. I'm 73 years old, but when I was 20 and I had just gotten married, immediately after that, I periodically had a repeating dream that was nothing more than me crying with in extreme sorrow for no reason. It would wake me up every time. I'd have to wake my husband up to console me because it was that upsetting. 10 years this went on, and he went away on a hunting trip where they would fly in to fish and hunt up in Canada. It was time for them to come home, and that night I had this dream that I was seeing him dead in wreckage with his friend. I walked around the wreckage with a man that I didn't know, and he'd tell me, because he didn't try to figure out what happened, he'd tell me they starved to death, and I said, no, they didn't. They had enough food, muff for twice as long. No, you're right, he said, were poisoned. They drank bad water. And I said, you can't tell me that because they took stuff to put in the water to make it pure. And he says, all right, they went the wrong way. I said, oh, well, I don't know about that. And then from that, and they were dead in this wreckage, it flashed to me and two of my daughters, one on each side, standing in front of a closed coffin. From that, it flashed to us walking diagonally across a parking lot to a cemetery. Then from that, it went to the exact same crying dream that I had had for 10 years. I woke up in the morning, or woke up from that dream, just sweating, bolted up. Oh my God, it was only a dream. Thank God it was only a dream. Went back to sleep. In the morning, I got up. He was supposed to come home during the night because they drive all night. Didn't come home. Got on the phone, found out that their plane was missing, and then that it had crashed, and they were killed in the accident.
Oh,
in the crash.
Karen.
And then we only had, of course, one day of funeral, and then my daughters stood next to me in front of a closed coffin. Then we walked diagonally across the church parking lot to the cemetery, and it was identical. It's as vivid today as it was then.
Karen, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your story. And it seems uncanny almost, but Karen, thank you so much. Deirdre Barrett, you know what I'm hearing in a lot of these callers? I hear people wanting to talk about the content of their dreams. And perhaps that we don't, as a society, talk about them enough. I'm actually, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I am quite touched and surprised by how intimate details we have callers telling about what's going on in their dream lives and how sometimes that maps to reality. Are we not, as a society, taking our dream lives seriously enough?
Well, I think we're not one uniform society. I think there are all kinds of subcultures and family norms, and some take dreams very seriously and welcome lots of dream sharing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly alive and true in some subsets of America today. And then there are other subsets where that doesn't really get welcomed with an outlet.
Well, so, I mean, earlier this hour, Alice was telling us about how post-Sigmund Freud, perhaps, you know, the science and research wasn't looking to dreams enough to understand them enough. Has that changed now? Is there sort of a renaissance of study around dreams? I mean, you're the former president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams.
Yes, I think what one's seeing, especially a renaissance of, is the more neurological brain-based research. Various kinds of brain imaging have just grown so rapidly in the last 10 years that neuroscience is a field that's exploding in all directions. But it also means that we can look at much more detail about what's happening during dreaming. There was a real heyday in the 50s when the EEG and what's happening with brain waves were first developed, when we discovered the sleep cycle and REM sleep and when people were dreaming. And then there wasn't too much more to do with the existing equipment until the last decade, when there's so many extremely detailed ways of looking in at the brain. So the physiologic is certainly exploding. In terms of just more dream content work, though, I think there have always been some psychologists very interested and some very behavioral ones who just pay no attention to dreams. But I think we see those same dichotomies in the general population, mm-hmm. that some people are fascinated by them, and I think those tend to be people who naturally recall a fair amount of vivid dream content, and they're people who just, you know, are not interested, and they're the low recallers or the ones who have sort of dim, fragmented dreams themselves. Yeah. I think there's a strong correlation with your own dream life and how interested you are.
Well, because for every caller who's called in and wants to share the deep details of their dreams, we have listeners like Ian Barry, who commented on our website, "I can't think of anything more underwhelming than telling someone about your dream, or even more so hearing about someone else's dream." So, Ian, you had your say. Alice, Rob, we've just got about a minute or two left here to go. I just wonder, you spent a long time researching this book, talking to scientists in the field. Even you went to a lucid dreaming workshop. I mean, what is your biggest takeaway for why we should value what's going on in our minds as we sleep?
It's just that for those of us who have vivid dream lives and who recall a lot of our dreams, they really can clue us into things that are going on emotionally that we might otherwise not pay attention to. And I've really been touched by, throughout the process of working on the book, how many people have really wanted to talk to me about dreams and have come to me and confided in me about their dreams. And there seems to be a real appetite among some people for talking about their dreams and having someone listen to them.
Okay. And Deirdre Barrett, we've just got a couple seconds to go here. But for those folks listening who want to sort of better access or use their dreams for benefit in their waking life, like, what would you recommend they do?
Well, I mean, there's Read Alice's book, there's Read My Book, The Committee of Sleep, but also for people who don't have other friends who are interested in dreams, in the age of the internet, you can go to the Association for the Study of Dreams website, and they both have online groups, and they'll put you in touch with local groups. So I think it's both easy to find information in books and websites, and easy to find fellow dream interested people these days.
Well, Deirdre Barrett, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and author of The Committee of Sleep, How Artists, Scientists, and Athletes Use Dreams for Creative Problem Solving and How You Can Too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
And Alice Rubb, author of Why We Dream, The Transformative Power of Our Nightly Journey. It was great to have you, Alice. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.